microphone even when you're not using a phone call and just record what you're doing in the room.
Well, Edin Omanovich is an advocacy director at Privacy International. He has said that it is very alarming that surveillance capabilities developed in some of the world's most advanced spying agencies are actually being packaged and exported around the world for profit. He also has said the proliferation of such intrusive surveillance capabilities is extremely dangerous and poses a real and fundamental threat to human rights and democratization. Now, why he takes that stance is pretty obvious. The watchdog group that he works for, Privacy International, it's a group that investigates surveillance, actually released a report back in 2014 on the global surveillance industry. It identified 27 Israeli companies. That's the highest number per capita of any entity or regime in the world. Then you have the U.S. that leads the world, but in sheer number of surveillance companies, that number is 122. Now, these numbers have surely increased since then. Let's now follow the spy trail. Many Israeli surveillance companies actually help U.S. companies collect information, such as the U.S. phone giant AT&T. So basically, you have Israeli surveillance companies helping AT&T collect data. It collects internet traffic and billions of emails. Now, that information was then forwarded to the U.S.'s National Security Agency, the NSA. Now, this was revealed in leaks by the now famous whistleblower, Edward Snowden.
My name's Ed Snowden. I'm 29 years old. I work for Booz Allen Hamilton as an infrastructure analyst for NSA in Hawaii. If you realize that that's the world that you helped create, and it's going to get worse with the next generation and the next generation who extend the capabilities of this sort of architecture of oppression, you realize that you might be willing to accept any risk, and it doesn't matter what the outcome is. If they want to get you, they'll get you in time. The greatest fear that I have regarding the outcome for America of these disclosures is that nothing will change.
Okay, that gives you an idea there. And this is what Snowden has actually said about the Pegasus spying software today.
But the NSO group is only one company of many. And if one company smells this bad, what's happening with all the others? I mean, when I look at this, what the Pegasus project has revealed is a sector where their only product are infection vectors, right? They don't, they're not security products. They're not providing any kind of protection, any kind of prophylactic. They don't make vaccines. The only thing they sell is the virus.
Now, why does all of this matter? I mean, what does this even have to do with Israel, with Pegasus software? Well, because what we're about to tell you here makes what Pegasus did look like child's play. And it all started with this revelation. CIA Chief David Petraeus, back in the year 2014, said, "We will spy on you through your dishwasher." What does that exactly mean? Spy through our dishwashers? Well, this is what he actually said. Transformational is an overused word, but I do believe it properly applies to these technologies in reference to, of course, the online appliances, smart appliances that are connected online. And he further on went to say, particularly to their effect on clandestine tradecraft. Now, this meant more and more personal and household devices, from TVs to car navigation systems to light switches, laptops, cell phones, well, the list is actually endless, can be used and most probably is being used to spy on people. Well, do you have a hard time believing that? I mean, we sure did. But let us show you this piece of evidence that is indeed the case. What you see over here, Samsung Smart TV Privacy Policy. It actually issued this. It's in the boxes. And it says, please be aware that if your spoken words include personal or other sensitive information, that information will be among the data captured and transmitted to a third party through your use of voice recognition. Just let that sink in. To a third party through voice recognition, personal or other sensitive information. Yes, that what you say in front of your phone could actually be listened to by somebody else. I mean, this is kind of reminiscent of George Orwell's book, 1984. This excerpt here, any sound that Winston made above the level of a very low whisper would be picked up by it, moreover, so long as he remained within the field of vision, that is, in reference to a television. Well, for further analysis on this matter, let's bring in David Lindorf. He's an American reporter who joins us. David Lindorf is an American investigative reporter. He actually has been a columnist for Counterpunch and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. His work actually has been highlighted by Project Censored 2004, 2011, and 2012. David, welcome. So, Pegasus spyware used to target journalists. You know that. A consortium of 17 media outlets, as it was reported. Activist researchers found that this software targeted their smartphones. And you have lawyers, teachers, and other people like executives also to have been targeted. French President Emmanuel Macron, Iraqi President Barham Saleh. What do you think about that? I mean, do you think that their motives, what are the motives here by developing the software?
Well, I haven't seen any articles that have made that point yet, but it would be surprising if they weren't using this to go after the organizers of the, you know, the boycott of products made in the occupied West Bank. And, you know, because that's a major concern of the Israeli government. So, and there's been a lot of activity around that within the U.S. by Israeli organizations, pro-Israeli organizations, and probably Mossad. So it would be a surprise to me if they weren't using this also to go after the organizers of BDS, which is quite a successful boycott campaign in the U.S.
All right. Now, this investigation was published by 17 media organizations, as we said, led by the Paris-based nonprofit journalism group by the name of Forbidden Stories. Now, the following takes a closer look at Forbidden Stories executive director and founder, Laurent Richard, who made statements on this matter.
Spying, and the depth of it, is at the heart of the Pegasus scandal. Heads of states, like from France, are furious. But as a source of the information, the Paris-based nonprofit journalism group Forbidden Stories, credible? Executive director and founder, Laurent Richard. His information appears solid.
So Pegasus is the name of a software that is sold by the NSO company. And NSO company is selling that software to state actors, to governments. And the mission of that software is to spy and to get all the information about the targets.
His reference to a list is interesting, which is where the French president's name appears, along with other heads of states.
We see the phone numbers of the President Macron in the list. We don't have the evidence that he was really infected by the software. We see at least an interest from an NSO customers with the Morocco authorities to enter the phone numbers into their system.
Even stranger is why the French president is using a personal phone to conduct official business.
It's quite concerning because actually we need to know why the president is still using a personal phone to have some conversation, and is that a good idea to do so? The second thing is that we need to know exactly what happened with the phone of the president and how much transparent the French authorities will be about the result of that kind of investigation.
And the depth of the malware is revealed by Laurent Richard.
This is a private market with no regulation at all. So there is nothing to protect you. And the bad news in that you, if you are infected, if your phone is hacked, you don't know that because there is no sign. You don't have to click on anything. It's an invisible attack. It's an invisible attack against democracy because you see with the profile of the targets, with the journalists, the human rights defenders, all those people who are playing a big role in the societies because they are informing the public opinion, because they are playing an economic role, because they want to change the political system, all those people who at some point will represent a danger.
So far, the NSO Group, a private company, has denied the reports that the Pegasus software was responsible for mass surveillance of journalists, human rights defenders, and business executives. Now, what makes the story interesting is that it has insisted and reassured that all sales were approved by Israel. Now, doesn't that then make Israel guilty? Oppressive technology is how this software is described. Experts have warned about Israel's long history of exporting cutting-edge weaponry in order to improve or foster diplomatic relations. Well, Israeli weapons are exported through the weapons trade with countries in the Middle East, Africa, and in Asia. Joel Guzansky from the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv has admitted that Israeli weapons exports through the weapons trade with countries in the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. He further said, sometimes the damage is bigger than the benefit, since Israel might be seen as someone who helps autocratic regimes suppress civil society. Okay, both of our guests rejoin us for this section. Vern Lyon, former CIA officer, and David Lundorf, who's an American reporter. Vern, let me first come to you. Pegasus spyware was sold to dozens of countries like Bahrain, like Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, despite them being accused of human rights violations, and claiming that it actually vets the clients based on their human rights records. And here is where it gets interesting, Vern. Insiders disclosed that the important role played by the Israeli Ministry of Military Affairs when it came to putting NSO Group's clients. Multiple sources actually have corroborated the fact that Israeli authorities actually pushed for Saudi Arabia to be added to the list of customers despite the NSO Group's hesitations. So case is closed. Israel is guilty, isn't it?
Well, guilty of what? Selling a software, making it available to governments in the Middle East. Obviously, the Israelis are way ahead of most countries with this kind of software. And since it's a private company, it is going to sell it, not just to governments, but to private companies as well. And how they can control the use of it is a good question. So is Israel guilty of perhaps letting the software be used by unscrupulous governments, organizations, people? Yes, I think they probably are.
I mean, isn't there something wrong, though, Vern, with selling software that can be used to target, let's say, dissident groups?
Well, if the original purpose of the spyware, when being sold to governments, was to carry out what I would call legitimate intelligence activities, which all governments do if they have the capabilities, that's understandable.
All right, David, over to you to sell spyware with the aim of not only spying without one's knowledge, but to actually crack down on people, especially when the people are revolting, let's say, or they're opposed to the government. Regimes are using it to basically silence dissent, like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, or some African countries. Isn't there something wrong with that, David?
Well, I don't know enough to say that they're guilty. I know enough to say that reputable news organizations have said that they've probably done this and that there's government involvement from top to bottom in NSO. It's former Mossad people. You know, it's doing things that the Israeli government wants done. It's to states that the Israeli government is supportive of. And so, you know, it's sort of like if A plus B and B plus C, then probably A plus C. I'll go far enough as to say that, I find reliable news organizations are saying this. So I wait to see more. The French government obviously is investigating it now because of the involvement of NSO doing things to actually their president, Macron. We'll see. I will not be astonished at anything that these investigations turn up. And I'm sure that other U.S. news organizations now are looking into it further.
Okay, that was David Lindorf. He is an American reporter. I'd like to thank him, and also I'd like to thank former CIA officer Vern Lyon for his thoughts. I'll be back with my final thoughts. The Israeli surveillance industry is neatly packaged and sold as security tools for respective governments. But the wider and more important use that it has for the buyers, well, to make sure that people's movements and their conversations are controlled, especially if these are opposing views against the government. Now, whistleblower Edward Snowden can give a better explanation as to where things stand when it comes to this very important issue, which basically, at a minimum, is an invasion of privacy.
The solution here for ordinary people is to work collectively. This is not a problem that we want to try and solve individually, because it's you versus a $1 billion company. What can you do to protect yourself from Google? A little, but you can't solve the problem. It's the same when we're talking about the NSO group. You can make yourself safer, right? But we will not be safe until we change the game.
That does it for this edition of the program. Your questions and comments are always welcome. From Mikko Vetälä and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
There is an ongoing but hidden Israeli regime war on the Palestinians, which is rarely highlighted or even known. It is a water war, which has been in the making for decades, says Ramzi Barud, journalist, in an article published under the heading "Murder of Menacing Water Technician on Shadow Wars in West Bank." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. There is an ongoing but hidden Israeli regime war on the Palestinians, which is rarely highlighted or even known. It is a water war, which has been in the making for decades. On July 26th and 27th, two separate but intrinsically linked events took place in Ain al-Helwa area in the occupied Jordan Valley and near the town of Beita, south of Nablus. In the first incident, Jewish settlers from the illegal settlements of Maskut began construction in Ain al-Helwa Spring, which has been a source of fresh water for villages and hundreds of Palestinian families in that area. The seizure of the spring has been developing for months, all under the watchful eye of the Israeli regime occupation army. Now, the Ain al-Helwa Spring, like most of the Jordan Valley's land and water resources, is annexed by the fake regime of Israel. Less than 24 hours later, Shadi Omar Salim, a Palestinian municipal employee, was killed by the Israeli regime forces in the town of Beita. The Israeli regime army quickly issued a statement which expectedly blamed the Palestinian for his own death. The Palestinian victim approached the Israeli regime troops with a menacing manner while holding what appeared to be an iron bar. Before he was gunned down, the Israeli regime army claimed. If the iron bar claim was true, it might be related to the fact that Salim was a water technician. Indeed, the Palestinian worker was on his way to open the pipes that supply water to Beita and other adjacent areas. Beita, which has witnessed much violence in recent weeks, is facing an existential threat. An illegal Jewish settlement called Givat Eviatar is being built atop the Palestinian Sabih mountain, in Arabic, Jabal Sabih. As usual, whenever a Jewish settlement is constructed, Palestinian life and livelihood are threatened. Thus, the ongoing Palestinian protests in the area. The struggle of Beita is a representation of the wider Palestinian struggle. Unarmed civilians fighting against a settler colonial state that ultimately wishes to replace a Palestinian village or town with a Jewish settlement. There is another facet to what may seem a typical story, where the Israeli regime army and Jewish settlers work together to ethnically cleanse Palestinians. Mekorot. The latter is a state-owned Israeli regime water company that literally steals Palestinian water and sells it back to the Palestinians at an exorbitant price. Unsurprisingly, Mekorot operates near Beita as well. The Palestinian worker Salim was killed because his job of supplying water to the people of Beita was a direct threat to Israeli regime colonial designs in this region. Let us put this in a larger context. The Zionist regime does not just occupy Palestinian land, it also systematically usurps all of its resources, including water. In flagrant violation of international law, which guarantees the fundamental rights of an occupied nation, the occupied West Bank obtains most of its water from the mountain aquifer, which is divided into three smaller aquifers: the Western Aquifer, the Eastern Aquifer, and the northeastern aquifer. In theory, Palestinians have plenty of water, at least enough to meet the minimally required water allotment of 102 to 120 liters per day, as recommended by the World Health Organization, WHO. In practice, however, this is hardly the case. Sadly, most of the water in these aquifers is appropriated directly by the Zionist regime. Some call it water capture. Palestinians call it more accurately theft. While in Palestine, or the Palestinian occupied territories, which is called Israel, the daily per capita water consumption is estimated at 300 liters. Illegal Jewish settlers in the West Bank consume over 800 liters per day. The latter number becomes even more outrageous if compared to the meager amount enjoyed by a Palestinian, that of 70 liters per day. This problem is accentuated in the so-called Area C in the West Bank for a reason. Area C consists of nearly 60% of the total size of the West Bank, and unlike areas A and B, it is the least populated. It is mostly fertile land, and it includes the Jordan Valley, known as the breadbasket of Palestine. Despite the fact that the Israeli regime had in 2019 decided to postpone its formal annexation of that area, a de facto annexation has been in effect for years. The illegal appropriation of Ain al-Helwa Spring by illegal Jewish settlers is part of a larger stratagem that aims at appropriating the Jordan Valley one donum, one spring, and one mountain at a time. Of the more than 150,000 Palestinians living in Area C, nearly 40%, over 200 communities, suffer from severe shortage of clean water. That shortage can be remedied if Palestinians are allowed to drill new wells, expand current ones, or to use modern technologies to allocate other sources of fresh water. Not only does the Israeli regime army prohibit them from doing so, even rainwater is off limits to Palestinians. An Amnesty International report published in 2017 concluded Israel even controls the collection of rainwater throughout most of the West Bank and rainwater harvesting cisterns owned by Palestinian communities are often destroyed by the Israeli army. Since then, the situation became even worse, especially since the idea of officially annexing a third of the West Bank obtained widespread support in the Israeli Knesset and society. Now, every move made by the Israeli regime army and Jewish settlers in the West Bank is directed towards that end, controlling the land and its resources, denying Palestinians access to their means of survival and ultimately ethnically cleansing them altogether. The Beit HaMikdash protests continue, despite the heavy price being paid. Last June, a 15-year-old boy, Ahmad Bani Shamsa, was killed when an Israeli regime army bullet struck him in the head. At the time, Defense for Children International Palestine issued a statement asserting that Bani Shamsa did not pose any threat to the Zionist regime army. The truth is, it is Beit HaMikdash that is under constant Israeli regime threat, as well as the Jordan Valley, Area C, the West Bank, and the whole of Palestine. The protest in Beit HaMikdash is a protest for land rights, water rights, and basic human rights. Bani Shamsa and later Salim were killed in cold blood simply because their protests were mere irritants to the grand design of colonial occupying fake regime of Israel. The irony of it all is that the fake regime of Israel seems to love everything about Palestine, the land, the resources, the food, and even the fascinating history, but not the indigenous Palestinians themselves.
Around the World with Reporters.
Palestinians took part in a rally in the Gaza Strip marking the 20th anniversary of the killing of Abu Ali Mustafa, the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Abu Ali Mustafa was assassinated in an Israeli attack in Ramallah in 2001. Palestinians said they participated in this rally to renew their support for the Palestinian resistance, expressing they will continue the road of resistance in defending their rights.
Today, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine is marking the 20th anniversary of the assassination of our leader, Abu Ali Mustafa. By holding this huge rally titled With Knowledge and Resistance, we will build the next generation of freedom and victory. We view the resistance as the only way out of the current crisis. We have many allies from Iran to Syria, Lebanon and Al-Quds, which stand against the Israeli regime.
This rally comes in conjunction with the Resistance Front warning it won't tolerate any more Israel's reluctance to meet Palestinians' demands, especially those related to ending the suffocating siege imposed on the Gaza Strip.
Today, all Palestinian resistance factions are marking Abu Ali Mustafa's assassination, vowing to follow in the footsteps of their leaders. Today, Palestinians are involved in a continuous struggle against Israel, especially in Al-Quds, defending their lands. We call for a unified stance in fight against the occupation.
Organizers said this event marks the ongoing resistance until the main goals of all Palestinians are achieved. Resistance factions renewed their pledge to defend the Palestinian people and sent a new warning to the Israeli regime that the coming generations are the generations of liberation.
We believe that generations after generations will keep resisting against Israeli occupation. The Israeli regime should be held accountable for its crimes, and the international community should break its silence towards them.
Palestinians here stress on not only support their resistance and follow the steps of the leaders, but also defend their rights with all means until liberating all Palestine. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
What started as a quiet day for the residents of Keyham in Plymouth, southwest England, ended with a tragedy. A mass shooting by a white male who took six lives, including his own. The mood here, one of absolute shock and horror.
Sad as well, obviously, all the people that have lost their lives, the people that are injured, the people that are affected by it. It's just sickening.
It's completely wrong to kill innocent people and your own family. It's not fair. It's not acceptable. The guy needed help, evidently. He probably wasn't given the help he needed.
I mean, it is very scary. Like, you just don't want to go out, do you? You want to stay inside and be safe.
Jake Davidson, a 23-year-old apprentice crane operator, was a licensed gun owner who launched a lone wolf attack using a pump-action shotgun, according to witnesses.
It all started with the gunman shooting a woman in one of the houses up that hill behind me and ended with him taking his own life. Six lives lost in nearly 6 minutes.
Police said his motive was still unknown.
There is no motive as we know at present. Again, that will be subject to inquiry, but we are at the moment not considering terrorism or a relationship with any far-right group or any such other group.
But Davidson's social media accounts offer a window into his state of mind. A case in point, a video post on YouTube where he considers himself as the Terminator.
The whole premise of the Terminator movies is that, you know, everything's rigged against you. There's no hope for humanity. You know, we're on the brink of extinction.
He was also believed to have been a member of Incel, a notorious online community of celibate men with misogynistic views. Police have called the incident not terror-related, raising questions about whether the police would give the same designation if the gunman were someone from a minority group. The UK has stringent gun ownership laws. The last time such an incident happened was in 2010, perpetrated by a taxi driver who killed 18 people and injured several more. It's almost clear Davidson was radicalized online, which begs the question whether the authorities could have done more to prevent the horrifying killing spree. Saeed Puriza, Plymouth.
Another illegal move on Yemen soil has taken place by the United Kingdom as it has sent 40 soldiers of its special forces and an electronic warfare unit to Al-Mar province in eastern Yemen on the pretext of finding the perpetrators of an attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman last month.
Such UK moves in Yemen are not new, whether in Al-Mahra or elsewhere. Britain has an agent in the region, the UAE. All of Britain's efforts in Yemen, through its Emirati proxy, are focused on advancing the interests of the Israeli regime. What's happening today is considered a betrayal to the country by former President Abdrabbuh Mansour Hadi. He has kept mum in the face of the British-Israeli moves in violation of Yemen's sovereignty.
An observer believes Saudi Arabia is the party behind the recent attack on the ship and says the deployment of the UK forces is aimed at justifying the presence of Saudi Arabia in Al-Mara as the regime has failed to take control of the province that has the longest coastal strip on the Arabian Sea.
The deployment of British soldiers to Al-Mahra came in the wake of the attack carried out by Saudi Arabia against the Mercer Street oil tanker. Ansar Allah was accused of being behind the attack, but this accusation was later denied. The presence of the British forces was planned beforehand, since Saudi Arabia has failed to control the province of Al-Mahra, and many people there are against the presence of Saudi forces, and they cannot remain there for a long time, as there are capable military forces in the country.
The people of Al Mahra have repeatedly voiced protest against the presence of Saudis on their land. However, the presence of foreign forces in Yemen is not limited to the UAE, Saudi Arabia, or the UK. A US plane carrying 300 American soldiers and officers, along with 12 Black Hawk helicopters, arrived in Aden in southern Yemen last month.
Yemenis say the recent UK move proves that colonial ambitions by foreign powers are rising rapidly amid fragile situation in the southern and eastern areas of Yemen. They have also made it clear that they will continue fighting until all of Yemen's land is liberated and foreign forces are pushed out of the country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Sudan has officially agreed to hand over ousted President Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court, along with other officials wanted over the Darfur conflict. The International Criminal Court chief prosecutor held talks with Sudanese officials in accelerating practical steps to hand over those wanted by the court over alleged atrocities committed in Darfur.
I am pleased to announce that the reason I was late was I was signing a memorandum of understanding with the government of Sudan that was signed by me as the prosecutor and by the Minister of Justice.
Al-Bashir is currently in Khobar prison in the Sudanese capital. He was dismissed and arrested in April 2019 following a massive popular protest movement against him. ICC Chief Prosecution Karim Khan said he will accomplish his mission in order to meet the expectations of the international community, especially with regard to Security Council resolutions to achieve justice about the victims of Darfur. Last week, the Sudanese cabinet approved Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court in what was considered as a new step towards trying al-Bashir before this international judicial body in The Hague. In 2009, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for al-Bashir, accusing him of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity during the armed conflicts in Darfur that erupted in 2003 and killed more than 300,000 people.
The Sudanese government decision to ratify the Rome Statute will make the government closer to international justice. But as observers say, it also divides the political parties in the country for and against. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
Ibrahim Raisi handed to Parliament a list of his proposed cabinet ministers a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators now have 1 week to review the credentials of Raisi's picks before an open vote of confidence session is held with the presence of the president himself to defend his nominees.
For 1 week, 13 Parliament commissions will be working 3 shifts a day where they will be host the proposed ministers, asking them about their plans and visions. 3 days after the one-week time frame is over, open sessions will be held in Parliament where the proposed ministers will take the podium one by one to lay out their plans and take questions from lawmakers.
The list consists of 19 nominees for 19 ministerial posts. Among the proposed names are Hossein Amir Abdullahian as the new foreign minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani as the defense minister, and Ismail Khatib as the intelligence minister. Lawmakers seem to not have issues with the proposed list and have promised to be cooperative with the new administration.
There will definitely be synergy and convergence between Parliament and the government. We need to work together to solve the country's economic problems. We are determined to remove the illegal sanction imposed on the nation, so lawmakers and the new administration must join hands to achieve this goal.
Ibrahim Raisi won the June 18th election by landslide, securing 64% of the vote. He was sworn in on August 4th, 2 days after he was officially endorsed by Iran's leader. Raisi had 2 weeks to introduce his proposed cabinet lineup, but he released the list a week ahead of the deadline. Parliament says it will be swift to review the nominated ministers in order to speed up the formation of the new cabinet.
If all goes as planned, open floor vote of confidence sessions will be held after the week-long deliberations over the credentials of the proposed ministers will conclude behind closed doors. Given the close ties between the Iranian parliament and the new government, lawmakers expect that the vote of confidence process will wrap up in a matter of 3 work shifts. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In
In an attempt to blunt international opposition to Israeli settlement construction in the occupied territories, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is pushing through plans for more than 2,000 settler units in the occupied West Bank, and at the same time has decided, after long years, to grant a rare authorization for 836 Palestinian homes in Area C of the occupied West Bank. It's virtually impossible for Palestinians to get construction permits from Israeli authorities. Palestinians say Bennett is trying to deceive the world by the so-called equalization.
All this announcement is just to tell a fake message to the world that we are equalizing, and you know, so we give the Palestinian permissions. It's not true that we are destroying. This is like a wrong message that will be given to the international community. We should confront it as a Palestinian, and also international community should also confront that. This is a Palestinian occupied land, and Israel don't have the right either to build the settlements or to give the Palestinians in their homeland and permission to build their houses.
Under the interim Oslo Agreement signed between the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Israeli regime in 1993, the West Bank was divided into three areas: Area A under Palestinian control, Area B under Palestinian and Israeli control, and Area C under full Israeli control, and this comprises some 60% of the occupied West Bank. Israel prevents Palestinians from constructing private or public buildings in Area C under different pretexts, such as using the land as military training zone, or it locates it close to settlements, and other claims.
Israel is controlling Palestinians' lives in these areas. It prevents them from constructing new homes in their own lands. The new move is aimed at covering up Israel's future plans for new settlement projects in the Palestinian lands.
At the end of the day, it's almost impossible for Palestinians in Area C to get Israeli-issued building permits. Moreover, Israeli forces on a daily basis destroy and demolish Palestinian structures in the same area for lack of construction authorization, despite the policy deemed illegal by the international community.
Palestinians don't take Israel's new move seriously, saying what matters for Tel Aviv is to execute its plan known as the Classified C Areas, which is aimed at putting an end to the presence of Palestinians on the mentioned areas. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
To show its goodwill to find a peaceful solution to the years-long crisis in Yemen, Yemen's Ansarullah has put forward a new initiative with 9 points to tackle the current crisis.
The initiative put forward by the Ansarullah leader serves the interests of all Yemeni people. I believe it is an appropriate opportunity for all conflicting sides to get out of the current predicament and avoid military battles. With this initiative, Ansarullah reaffirms once again that it is keen on finding a political solution to the conflicts in Yemen.
The spokesman of Ansarullah movement, Muhammad Abdus Salam, said the initiative includes stopping the Yemeni army's operations in Marib, reactivating the Marib gas station to generate electricity for all Yemen, and forming a joint administration from the people of Marib to maintain security and expel the terrorist groups from the city.
The initiative launched by Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi's aim to stop war in Marib. The people of Marib should have the final say when it comes to their political fate. Meanwhile, the roads must be open for the free movement of Yemenis. This initiative is an appropriate measure that will benefit the Yemeni people and establish a comprehensive political and economic solution to the current crisis.
The free movement of all Yemenis, Abdus Salam said, should be guaranteed, as well as the release of all the detainees from the prisons of the Saudi-backed forces in Marib. Ansarullah's initiative came in conjunction with the UN's appointment of Hans Grundberg of Sweden as its new envoy for Yemen.
Many here say changing the UN envoy will not solve the problem, because as things stand, this is the US which controls the situation and leads the war on Yemen behind the scene. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Hundreds of thousands of local Afghans have fled their cities and villages in northern and northeastern provinces due to back-to-back collapse of most provincial capitals in the north and northeast to Taliban. Some displaced families have arrived in the capital, Kabul, and they have nowhere to go but the roadside or parks like the one here in central Kabul, That is why they welcome any move that could mitigate their misery. The advances have displaced more families across the country. Some displaced people accuse local officials of making secret deals with Taliban.
Our city fell to Taliban without any exchange of fire. The same story went on in Ghazni city, where its governor was arrested by the NDS over handing over the city to Taliban. This proves that there are some secret deals behind the collapse of our cities.
The displaced Afghans urge warring sides to stop turning more cities into the battlefields by resuming a meaningful intra-Afghan negotiation.
We, the people of Afghanistan, are the main victims of war. We have lost all we had. Ceasefire is the only way to get out of the current crisis. The government and Taliban must sit for talks and resume a meaningful negotiation.
Afghan government has ordered the country's Ministry of Awqaf and Hajj to open the doors of all mosques in government-controlled areas for displaced families, and that the government is going to fully support them under close cooperation with the international humanitarian agencies. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Meet Noura, an Iranian-made COVID vaccine, which is now making a name for itself. Developed by Iran's Baghiyat Allah University, affiliated to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the vaccine wrapped up the first human trial stage and now kick-started the second phase.
The first trial phase involved giving jabs to 70 people. The vaccine has not created any serious side effects in the volunteers, so we can now conclude that the vaccine is safe. The second phase will cover up to 500 volunteers, and the third and final stage will inject Noura to at least 20,000 people. It's only then we can decide on the efficiency of the vaccine.
Noura is a recombinant vaccine, which experts say provides stronger immune response to the virus compared to jabs that work based on other methods, such as mRNA and inactivated virus. Noura is administered in three stages. The first and second doses are injected 21 days apart, and the third one is administered 2 weeks after the second shot.
While Noura jumped a bit late on the bandwagon to fight the coronavirus, it stands out as the only Iranian vaccine that can be administered to children and teens. Experts hope that this would make it safe to reopen schools.
With less than 1 month and a half left to the upcoming school season, authorities in Iran are still debating whether or not to resume in-person classes, which have in the past year given way to online learning. Noura developers say they're trying their best to get their jabs to the market, as they're certain that their vaccine will protect children between 12 and 18 against the coronavirus.
Based on our studies, our vaccine is both safe and effective to be used for people between 12 and 18 years old. Simultaneously with the second trial phase, we'll also kickstart the first stage of the trials on volunteers from this age group.
Developers say if all goes as planned, Noura will hit the market in 3 months. This as Iran has already rolled out its first local vaccine dubbed Coviran, with a monthly output of up to 15 million doses per month. The country also plans to release Covpars, among other jabs, within the next 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, has blasted the decision to hold joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises in South Korea this month. Her statement, read on official media, also called for the removal of U.S. troops and weapons from the Korean Peninsula.
The U.S. is determinedly pushing forward with these aggressive war drills when international attention is focused on the development of the situation on the Korean Peninsula. It is indeed the chief architect destroying peace and stability in the region. And this also proves that diplomatic engagement and dialogue with no strings attached touted by the present U.S. administration is hypocrisy to cover up its aggressive nature.
The U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has reached out for, quote, unconditional talks with Pyongyang. Although U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over North Korea's nuclear weapons program remain in place, experts consider North Korea's perspective.
The most important thing is the content of the joint exercises. Officially, they are described as defensive in nature, but if you look closely, they employ very offensive strategies, preemptively striking North Korea, removing state leadership, and capturing North Korean territory. It's threatening from the North Korean standpoint.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in had been trying to generate peace with North Korea, but Seoul's close alliance with Washington and purchase of major U.S. weapons has hindered his efforts toward Pyongyang.
The decision to go ahead with the joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises has already impacted inter-Korean relations. In late July, hotline communications between the two Koreas were restored after being severed for more than a year. However, since the announcement of the drills, North Korea is no longer answering South Korea's calls. Frank Smith, Seoul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The world's leading insurance companies, especially U.S. ones, are underwriting and investing in industries that drive planetary heating, destroy ecosystems, and violate human rights. According to Insuring Disaster, a new report released recently by a United Kingdom-based financial industry watchdog. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. Insurance Giants, Worsening Climate Crisis, Biodiversity Loss and Human Rights Violations. Stay tuned for more. Leading insurance companies, especially U.S. ones, are underwriting and investing in industries that drive planetary heating, destroy ecosystems, and violate human rights, according to Insuring Disaster, a new report released recently by a United Kingdom-based financial industry watchdog in what it described as the first comprehensive assessment of insurers' environmental, social, and corporate governance, ESG credentials. Share Action analyzed and ranked how 70 of the world's biggest insurance companies, together responsible for assets totaling $22 trillion, are approaching responsible investment governance, the climate emergency, biodiversity loss, and human rights. In contrast to their reputation as risk experts who assesses, manages, and help reduce social and environmental risks, the majority of large insurers fail to adequately address systematic risks such as climate change and biodiversity loss, wrote the authors of the report, which was based on company surveys and an examination of publicly available data. Almost half of insurers, that is about 46%, received an E, the lowest grade, while another 17% received a D rating. Just 16% demonstrated a relatively strong performance that merited a rating of B or higher. Yet, even the leading insurer scored just over 50% of the available points, the report said. On average, insurers scored only 12% of all available points. We hope this unprecedented overview of the industry offers a wake-up call to insurers, report co-author Felix Nagrawala said in a statement. These ratings must improve and quickly if the industry hopes to survive a future built on renewables and equity, not fossil fuels and slave labor. No insurer received an AA or AAA rating, although five European companies received an A grade. The performance of U.S. insurers, meanwhile, was remarkably poor. Share Action gave an E to 75% of U.S. insurance companies, compared with 52% in Asia and 22% in Europe. Of the 12 lowest-ranked insurers with a property and casualty business, half were U.S. insurance giants Nationwide, AIG, Allstate, Genworth Financial, Protective Life, and Travelers that scored 5% or lower on issues of governance, climate, biodiversity, and human rights. Furthermore, of the 15 lowest-ranked life and health insurers, which scored 3% or lower on the four categories being evaluated, 9 were U.S. companies. RiverSource, Northwestern Mutual, Talcott Resolution, Pacific Life, Lincoln Financial Group, Protective Life, Mass Mutual, Brighthouse Financial, and Aflac. The U.S. insurance industry is buying its head in the sand as the rest of the world races to embrace a greener, cleaner, and more equitable future, said Nagrawala. Despite the sector's expertise in identifying, forecasting, and managing risk, it continues to support companies responsible for climate change, including those engaged in coal, tar, sands, and Arctic oil and gas. These aggregated results from this study showed that while the world's top insurers received an average score of 27% on the topic of governance, they performed even worse on the climate crisis, 11%, human rights, 8%, and biodiversity, about 3%. By continuing to underwrite and invest in fossil fuel extraction and disregard the well-being of working people, by neglecting dangerous workplace conditions, gender and racial discrimination, child and forced labor in supply chains, and forced displacement of communities, insurance companies, particularly U.S. ones, are exacerbating environmental and social crises even more than other actors in the financial sector. The stronger ESG policies and practices, the report said. Despite the fact that insurers make up 12 of the 26 members of the United Nations convened Net Zero Asset Owners Alliance, and despite plans for a Net Zero Insurance Alliance, only 13% of asset insurers have made net zero commitments for investments, and just 3% have a net zero policy for underwriting activities, according to ShareAction. Insurers are better placed than any other type of private financial institution to exert pressure on the coal industry, as coal projects cannot be financed, built, or operated without insurance coverage, the report noted. But U.S. providers are largely failing to use this influence.